Welcome to Shut Up and Ride. This is episode 2 of our podcast. If you've already listened to episode 1, welcome back. If you haven't, maybe go back and listen, because in that episode, we talk about one of my co-hosts, the wonderful, brilliant Ben Atkinson, and where he kind of came from on this journey. But today, we are going to be talking about the wonderfully brilliant Simon Grieve. Welcome back to the pod, boys.
Hi, Jenny.
Hello, it's good to be back.
Excellent. Well, I say it's good to be back. It's taken quite a long time to wrangle you two into the same place at the same time, because you're both such busy people. Start with you, Simon. How are you? What's been going on? What's new in the life of an international event rider?
All is good, thank you. I've been doing quite a lot of teaching, which has been great, but a little less eventing, actually. We've had quite a few events cancelled, which is a real pain. But Burnham Market, I went to Burnham Market last week and it was absolutely amazing. The ground was incredible, and I've got quite a few people that I know that have kind of been saying, I'm just not sure I love it as much anymore, and it's just not as much fun as it used to be. And it's all because we've been through winter and it's been really hard and it's been really tough, and things are always going wrong, and then you kind of forget how brilliant it is. And then I went around the 3-star at Burnham Market. It's such a brilliant time. I loved every second of it, and it's reminded me why I like doing it. Well, why I love doing it. I was like, really good, actually.
Was that where you had your woohoo moment in the water, where horses' legs went from under them because
yes,
he jumps quite
yes.
big?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's it's something that he does. He jumps really big into water fences, and I slightly overrode it, I suppose. I kind of always expecting them to back off a little bit, and he just didn't, and he went pretty skyward. And then I've got to go and do some practice water jumping.
I was going to say straight away, the interview ahead of me wants to go, like, so now, because he actually looked really confident coming out, but will you be worried now that that's in his head, that water might mean an oopsie moment?
No, because he's done it quite a few times now.
Ah.
Which is, he did it at Thoresby as well, completely overjumped into the water at Thoresby. He just brings his... He kind of throws himself in, and then rather than letting go with his back legs and allowing himself to land, he slightly panics that he's thrown himself in, and he brings his back legs down too quick, so he ends up landing on all fours.
How on earth will you start to fix that? Sorry, so like last week you got to grill me on my world. I'm going to jump straight in on this, because I can understand the idea of you can have smaller fences into a water jump, but how would you go around really sort of helping change the horse, how it's thinking about approaching
exactly,
that?
That is exactly it. More small fences, just doing it over and over and over again, and, you know, just make it so it's not quite such a big deal. And let him make him think about his own technique as he's jumping into it. It doesn't have to be big.
I've got a question. This is because this podcast is all about asking the questions that we want to ask that we don't think we should ask.
Want to ask?
Am I going to be able to answer this question?
Well, it's just because I know you so well. I know I can get away with this question, but you've just said there that he's done it a few times. Do you think, in hindsight, you've missed a little gap in your training there? Like, do you think you could have done more in the preparation if he's done it a few times?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I've certainly done some. I've done schooling into water. And he's not done it. You know, he's not done it in training. I think maybe I need to assess how I approach water fences with him.
With him,
and
yeah.
not be quite so. You know, because I tend to be right. We're going whether you like it or not, kind of feel. And he's going anyway. And you know, yeah. In fact, he's kind of already gone. And I think maybe part of it is me as well. But yeah, but I definitely need to go and jump lots of fences into water.
I think
for confidence. But to be fair, he then went and. So you had a very similar fence, two fences later in the woods, quite a decent, well, a little, it was a little log, but with a decent drop on landing, and he jumped that beautifully and used himself correctly, and it felt really good. So I'm not gonna overthink it. Or I was saying to myself, I'm not gonna overthink it, it'll be fine. And now Jenny has completely ruined that.
Yeah, we're gonna make you overthink
but
it.
But no, because you are. You are a rider I know can like stop and self-assess, and you have a lot of horses to ride. You've got to, like, if they're talented, we know we can, you are brilliant at assessing a horse. You're fantastic with the young ones. So it would just be interesting for me. I'd be like, whenever a horse isn't going as well as I want or something happens, I'm like, oh my God, that was me. What have I done? So it's just very, I just wanted to throw that out there, because it's interesting, isn't it? Because some riders will go, no, I wouldn't miss a beat. No, I absolutely have trained this horse to perfection. But I know that
it's quite a thing with you know, as an event rider, with this horse, I got him, he'd done a lot of novices and he was kind of ready to do two-star and he was ready to maybe do an intermediate. Except he couldn't show jump at all. He was having four or five fences down at novice. And, which is not ideal, but now, like, he jumped double clear at in the three star at Burnham Market, going in the right direction there. But what I'm saying is, I didn't actually produce this horse to this level.
Okay.
So I don't know. There could be gaps there, but
that makes sense because that's we have that in our job a lot. It's why we try and buy horses that aren't trained, because sometimes I would rather have to I'd rather spend 2 years getting to the horse to that point than have a horse that someone else has already had a go, and maybe there's been an incident, you don't know what's happened, and I find that can be harder in terms of like coming into these fences, just sort of thinking with your, like, the specialization in the eventing, there's so much to have to think about. It's probably actually the part of the equine world I know the least about, but even with that, when you're talking about schooling them over the drop fences and stuff into the water, in that, have you got sort of like your separate things of, it's going to be very different just coming into a fence schooling and, you know, schooling over that fence. But then also you have, we all know that horses get their blood up when we've got them going on, when you've got, you know, if you've ever been on like a pleasure ride with friends or out hacking, you all go down a stubble field, they get going. So do you have to sort of then have to replicate that within your training? It's not enough to just approach the fence from six strides out and drop in. You need to be, like, could that be a fact? Would that be a factor you'd be thinking about? The horses running on into the fence, they're more, do you know what I mean, more going in their head, then add that to the fatigue and stuff. Would they be, how would you sort of calculate those things when you're preparing the horses for the cross country?
Yeah, it's a really difficult one, that one is, because it does make such a difference. You know, when the adrenaline's in there. I had a horse that I evented to five star level, who Jenny knows, Freddie, who's called Mr. Fahrenheit, who I don't event him anymore.
Mr. Fahrenheit.
And he's a proper cool dude, like absolutely not kind of hardcore. But he's very difficult because he's relaxed and chilled and easy in a cross-country schooling situation. Literally, he just knows, it's like, yeah, whatever. And he just kind of pops this and pops that and it's all fine. And then you get to a competition and you get to the start box and you get counted down and he is gone. And it makes it made it that I couldn't ride the horse. We had a fall as well, which kind of our partnership then kind of faltered then, and I kind of lost belief in him. I think he lost belief in me, so we parted company. But yeah, but he was a prime example of what you're saying. Sometimes it's very difficult to replicate that. And, you know, that's why, you know, training in competition is really important. You know, you get the really the top dogs like William Fox Pitt or Jock Padgett.
Yourself.
Actually did the same thing. Myself. But they actually, and Chris Burton as well, they have their system. They do smaller events before they're on the build-up to a big competition, and they'll go around an open intermediate with 50 time faults. They literally just crawl around, poodling along, and just popping and having a jolly nice time. It's very easy. And then when they get to the big one, they're inside the time. They're faster than everybody else. But the horses, they're working on rideability. And I think people forget about working on that.
And I suppose the difference between you two, so you have an oopsie moment in the water. And anyone wants to look at this moment, look on Simon's Instagram, because it's on there, isn't it, with Lucinda Green commentating over it. It was on Horse and Country and you clipped it out. So, Ben, if you want to go and see it, it's on his Instagram. I mean, your riding and your stickability. I think Lucinda even talks about your lower leg and how amazing it is. But what is so interesting is when you have a moment like that, whereas I suppose, Ben, when you have a moment like that where a horse has a wobble or a trip or whatever, you've got about 10,000 people in an arena only staring at you. Like, I know you have an audience, Simon, but it's not like that's where every
no one knows what I'm gonna do, though. That's where I get it easier. No one knows what I'm gonna do next.
Change the plan very easily.
There is no course, there is no test. I know that my job is to go in there and make people smile and clap. they've got to have fun.
Are you now, not entertained?
Yeah, and like, and within reason, you like, I know it sounds silly, but even like if I'm standing on them and I've got them in the long reins and I'm going over jumps and I go wrong and I stack it, like I have to like sort of crunch the ego and be like, in all seriousness, that's probably the audience's favorite part of the entire blooming show. So like they don't like they'll stick around like yeah, it doesn't
more than likely.
It's not. Our game is a bit different. Of course, there's things I want to happen. I know the plan. But we're a lot easier in that way. And to be fair, if things normally go wrong for me, there's not a lot of stickability. I've got horses with no tack on. They leave. Like, it's, yeah. But I think that is the big difference in that, like, you have, like, when Simon, you're saying that you land from that fence. Did you come off or did you stay on with this one?
No, I stayed on this time.
Yeah, so like, unless you've, so you, like, you have another fence to go to, you have the rest of the course to complete, you are in a time limit, so you have to crack on in that time, whereas, weirdly, because we're not competition, we get more free rein with certain things. Like, if I think a horse looks a bit odd in the middle of a show, I can pull up, check its legs, maybe even trot, like, have a look at it, make sure everything's all right, and then I can carry on and I don't get penalized for that or anything. Equally, I can fall off. This is, I'm the last equestrian discipline where I can get decked in the arena and get back on and carry on. And so in a lot of ways there, we have so much more freedom. So I have a lot of, take my hat off to you, being like, to have a stumble with a horse and then just be like, right, carry on, next thing.
Yeah.
Sit up and kick on.
Shut up and ride.
Exactly. So we've kind of straight away gone into current day, but this podcast episode 2 is about you, Simon Doe, from getting to know you, how it all came about and things like that. Because I know Ben researched you and everything. But I am going to start the questionones. I don't know why I said it like that. I apologize deeply to anyone listening. Kind of, if you were going to go and talk to 12-year-old Simon Greve, would he have known the trajectory that his life was going to take? And what would you say to that 12-year-old? Are you happy with how it's gone and where you've ended up? Like, does 12-year-old Simon know he's going to be an international event rider who completes Burley like 9 times and jumps that giant log?
Jenny Rudel, you're so good at questions, aren't you? That is very good. That is very good. Yes, the 12-year-old Simon was absolutely adamant that this is what he was going to do. Definitely.
Can 40-year-old Simon sit down and stay still and stop walking around?
Sorry, I just returned to the room. I've got the front door open and the dogs are everywhere. And when James gets home, he's going to go mad because I love lots of dogs. But they're all in, so it's all okay. Sorry. So, so 12-year-old Simon, if 42-year-old Simon spoke to 12-year-old Simon, 12-year-old Simon would be very proud because this is definitely what he would have wanted to have done. Whether he would have wanted to have won a 5-star or several 5-stars by now, I'm not sure about that one, to be honest. I think that's because Jenny said to me, when she said she wanted to do this, she wanted to, one of the things she wanted to ask me was, you're 42 years old and you haven't won a 5-star. How do you think about that? And then it's funny because then she ran me back about 20 minutes later. She said, I just suddenly realised that's actually a really rude question to ask. That wasn't too much, was it? I was like, no, not at all. It's fine. But yeah, I think I told my dad that I wanted to be an event rider when I was probably about 14 or 15, and he said that it was so ridiculous. It would be a really tough life, and you know, you'd lift hand to mouth, and it would be really tough, and it'd be, you know, you're very lucky because I went to a good school, and you know, I was very privileged as a kid. And he's like, and you won't have that because you won't have money. And we actually had a conversation quite recently about that because I said, can you remember that conversation? And he said, yes, I can actually remember having that conversation with you. And I was wrong about you because I thought you were more materialistic than you are. And you've actually done quite well considering.
Like,
thanks, Dad. That's very big of you.
How was that? Was that emotional or just like, yeah, done that? Like, how did that, if you could delve into that, that's, I mean, a moment of therapy right there, isn't it?
What, with my dad?
Hmm.
Yeah. No, not really. Dad's episode matters packed about everything. It's like, yeah, no, you shouldn't do that. But he's quite good at missing weight as well.
That's the opposite to my father. Ben, you look like you wanted to ask a question then, but also controlling the laughter at my bluntness of questions with.
Yeah, you're really delicate with those. No, I just
she's straight on in there.
So, how did that look as a journey from you? Like, so when you're sort of, you said like sort of 12 or 15, sort of that age, you want to be an eventer. Were you already in the sport? Were you already like deeply involved, and that's how you knew you wanted to do it? Or was it something that, was it the idea of it, or what you'd see, like the inspiration of other namers and stuff?
So I don't want to be boring because my life's not that interesting. So please do interrupt me if you think I'm going on. But so when I was probably about 9 or 10, probably younger, 8 or 9. My parents sold their house, and the house that we were moving into fell through, so we didn't actually have anywhere to live. And my mum's GP, this is so random, my mum's GP said, oh, we've actually got an annex that you could live in, you and your family, you know, for as long as you need until you find the house. So we ended up living in this annex for six months or so, I think. It might even be 12 months, and can't remember. And but these, it was this beautiful old rectory, massive house, beautiful garden, stables, fabulous place. But they owned event horses, and they owned a horse called King's Jester that Jane Thirlwall, that she was then, she's Jane Wallace now, she won Burley on it in 1988, and then she was silver medalist in the European Championships in 1989. And I was there throughout that period. We lived with them throughout that period, basically, of that success. And I was so inspired by that. I thought Jane was wonderful. I still think she's wonderful now. Amazing horsewoman. And I was really inspired by that. And we kind of got to go to these events. We got to kind of spend time with Jane. And I kind of got a bit of an idea about what it was all like. And I just, and I loved it. And my grandmother also, like before all of this, my grandmother was always really into eventing. And she used to go to Babington and Burley every year and watch. And she watched virtually every dressage test. And she'd write it all down in the program. And she was a really big inspiration for me as well. And she used to take me to Babington Burley every year. And yeah, so that's kind of where it started from, really, from that which is a bit random, really. And also, like, I was a complete pussy as a kid. Like, my first ever riding lesson. Yeah, that's true. Still am now. But I had my first riding lesson, and I didn't like it. I was a bit scared because I think the pony wasn't actually that nice. And I was like, Mum, I don't like it. I don't like it very much. And she's like, okay, well, that's fair enough, but you need to do something on a Saturday. So next week, Dad's going to take you, you're going to have a go at rugby. I was like, okay, I'll have a go at rugby. I went for rugby. And at the end of that, I was like, I want to go horse riding again. So it kind of, then I kind of had to learn to like horse riding after that. And then I turned into absolutely loving it and thinking it was the best thing ever. And I was also very wimpy when it came to doing cross-country stuff at the Pony Club when I was very small as well, which is, I was thinking about that actually the other day. I was like, it's really random that you were so nervous about going cross-country when you were that age. I missed the land now, but I'm relatively brave now.
What do you think made you nervous back then?
It's very strange.
Just because, like, I could understand someone young being nervous now. Because you see all the stuff on social, like, these days, you can see all the wrecks and everything, don't you? And you're like... the way the media makes it look, you're like, yeah, cross country eventing's like the Hunger Games. It's so dangerous. But then,
yeah,
it's where it is,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's really bizarre. I've got kind of full circle, like, because I started off like being very nervous about doing it. And to be fair, I did have a fall off of a pony at a hunter trial when I was quite young, and I think that kind of scared me a little bit. And then I kind of went through the motions of being a scaredy cat, and then I kind of turned that all around and then turned it into positive. And then I managed to start doing really quite big stuff. And I was always terrible. My nerves have always been a big issue for me. But I've managed to kind of deal with them a lot better. But now I'm starting to get older. Well, I was starting to think, oh, maybe I'm not quite as brave as I was. But actually, having done last week, I was like, actually, no, you're fine. You're fine. And it was all relative to what you're riding as well.
I love that analogy about the Hunger Games. All I've got in my head now is the title for this podcast being May the Fences Be for Forever in Your Favour.
I was just going to say, you just brushed over that quite. I love that I just turned it from being a negative thing to being positive in your mind. Like, is that something, do you find that that's something now you do quite a lot? Because I've seen, you know, when we're trying to organise the podcast and stuff, you'll be like, oh, I'm teaching 12 people today. Like, is that a big part for you when you're helping people? That you're like, is that almost like, a gift from your younger self because you were nervous and you've overcome it? Is that something that you help people with now?
I try. Yes. And I hope it kind of works. I hope they kind of take stuff from it. Because I was really nervous. And then I remember being very nervous and riding like an absolute what's it and ending up making my pony fall. And ever since that day, I was like, right, we need to change. Either you need to give up or, but I was still desperate to do it. It was so bizarre. Still desperate to do it. Either you give up or we need to change this. And I turned it all around. And when I got really nervous, I was like, right, so the safest thing you can do is be really positive and kick like hell. And that is true. Like, you know, the worst, when you start getting nervous, the worst thing you can do is, well, of course you can go and shut yourself away before the actual performance, but during, you've got to be like, right, we're in it. And either I'm in it 100% or we go home.
Yeah.
There's nothing in between. And that's kind of how I look at it now. But it also came back. I remember doing 5-star at Poe in Poe a few years ago. And we'd gone to all this trouble of driving all the way down there with this amazing, lovely horse. And it was a fantastic experience. And it was great to be there, whatever, whatever. And then on cross country morning, for some reason, I was in a really, like I say, I always get nervous, but I was in a particularly bad state that morning. And I came out of the start box like a bit of a wimp, basically. And I got to fence four, and it was this big table on top of a mound, down the mound, and then a big corner. And unsurprisingly, we ran out of the corner. And I flicked from being really quite scared to really angry, like really angry at myself. It wasn't the horse's fault, it was completely me. Angry at myself. I then proceeded to go around the rest of the course like an absolute demon, and it was probably the best round I've ever had around a 5-star. And I don't think I was inside the time, but I wasn't far away from being inside the time, having had a run out as well. And ever since then, I tried to make sure that my warm up is linked into the actual round, because always before I always was like, you've got to do your warm up, then you go to the start, then you start, and then off you go. Now you're in competition. Now I try. In a big situation, I try and treat my cross-country warm-up as part of the competition and give myself a bit of a talking to and be like, right, come on, let's go. And that also works. Sorry, that was a very long-winded story.
No,
but yeah, I think sometimes you've got to just turn it around and be like, right, so actually I'm scared or I'm really nervous for whatever reason you are, and turn and say, okay, so actually the safest thing I can do is get out there and mean it. And if you don't get out there and mean it, then you just don't bother. And I have said that to a few people recently, actually, who I teach. I'm like, look, you know, you need to decide whether you actually want to do this or not. You know, because either you don't do it anymore, or we need to be super positive about it, because that's the safest thing. So that is when accidents happen.
I know, like, mental health is really important to you and your campaigns for suicide awareness and things like that. And also, you have spoken out about being a gay man in eventing. So I'm really curious, and I've never asked you these questions, so I'm doing them now live on the podcast. At what point did you come out, and did you come out in the sport? Like, did you tell people within the sport? Like, how was, like, did you come out at school? Like, when did that happen? And do you think being in a sport where there are a lot of openly gay people, but do you think that helped being in a sport like that, that is very welcoming, or was it not welcoming? I'd love to know more about that process. And I'm sure there are a lot of young men out there as well who would love to hear it from your point of view, or might be struggling. I've never asked you about it, and because I don't actually know why I haven't.
So eventing was amazing. I kind of came out to my mum. I was quite late, but then it is a long time ago now. It's like over 20 years ago that I came out, and it was a very different, it sounds so stupid, but it was a very different world then. And it wasn't as accepted as it is now, acceptable as it is now, which made it more difficult. And I came out to my mum when I was at university, college, and, but I'd kind of been outed by somebody at college. So a lot of people knew that there was the rumours were going around that I was, and I found that really hard, and it was a really difficult time for me. That was
Because someone else had done it, or that you
But at the same time, I'm such a, you know, I'm so indecisive about certain things. I can't imagine I would have ever told anybody if I hadn't been outed. I would have done eventually, but like in, even at 21, that's quite now. That's old to be coming out, you know. But then it kind of all materialized, and I did tell mum, and then mum told dad. I said to mum, I didn't tell anyone because I'm not really sure myself, even though I was. And so then she told dad, and then and my sister and stuff. So everybody kind of knew, and then everyone kind of became aware of eventing, and eventing is an unbelievable. Well, equestrianism in general is unbelievable when it comes to inclusivity, because I have never had anybody be negative to me. Other than one person, but it's years ago, and she's completely unaware that she was at the time. I've not had anybody be negative about my sexuality. It's wonderful in that respect. They're wonderful people, and it's just so bizarre because you get, especially at that time, you get some real stick in the mud older people involved in horsey sport, and all of them are like, oh yeah, no, everyone's gay, you know, well, not everyone, but, you know, like, and I think that's wonderful because it's so unusual in most sports, like in football, you know, being gay is still considered to be, is faux pas the right phrase? Not faux pas, yeah, you know, the wrong thing, or it's going to affect your career. And until relatively recently, that was the case with being an actor, or, you know, in so many, but in the horse world, you know, like Blythe Tate was well known for being gay when he was at the height of his career. That's a long time ago now.
Yeah, a long time ago. I see you nodding away there, Ben. There's obviously something resonating with you. And
no, I think it's like, I was quite old before I, and this sounds ridiculous, but just from sort of the world I grew up in. So like my mum and dad met doing musical theatre. I did musical theatre until I was 20, and then been in the horse world. And my two worlds I was in were those things. So it was a weird thing for me as I grew older to discover that sexuality was something that people had an issue with and stuff. Cause I'd always been in such open-minded places growing up. And so never saw, do you know what I mean? It's just, that's just life. And I think it's a wonderful thing you point out there, especially for young people growing up and stuff. Maybe if you're like the horse world, the equestrian world is a good place to get involved in that side. Like, you know, like you say, it is inclusive. There is, and when, I suppose we don't really think about it often. Well, I don't, because I'm like, I don't really fall into
you
any
don't, because it's so,
minorities.
Because it's so open.
Ever. Yeah, and it is so open, and it's so, yeah, it isn't a question of any kind. And I think as well, like, the something we forget about in the equine sports as well is, even within, like, within competition, all ages, all genders, all together, you know, there's no segregation in any way, shape or form. You can have people of all walks of life and creed and color and sexuality and everything, all genders all together. And I think that's something that's quite beautiful about the equestrian world.
The only thing I would say though is in the equestrian world that any issue with color, that is one thing that I have experienced negativity with. There aren't that many people of color that do event or show jump, and it still is. Look, sometimes that, you know, I've spoken to quite a lot of guys that have done that, and they do feel that they are discriminated against within that. So that is one negative about it.
It's still classed as elitist, and it is still quite elitist in a lot of ways.
And the elite, the word elitist. I was in London today doing just preparing for my Mont Blanc climb, and the guy that was helping me with this altitude training, and he's doing the London Marathon this weekend, and we were talking about sport, and obviously I was like, oh yeah, no, well, so this is what I do, and I was being terribly negative about our sports. I kept to find myself saying, but the word elitist came up because it is, you know, you need wealth to be able to do this sport. Whether it be your own wealth or it be somebody else's, we were saying today, you know, it's, unfortunately, it's not with him doing his running. He's obviously a very talented runner, this guy. I said, you know, either you're good at it or you're not good at running. The end, and it doesn't really, you know. Whereas with us, it's like you're only really as good as the horses you've got, And if you've not got any money, then you're not going to have good horses. And that makes it elitist, I think.
I was just going to say, I think it's a strange conversation, like at which level? Do you know what I mean? So, like, I think there's an argument for it being an elitist sport at all levels. Like you say, from having to have the pony on working livery, just because in the same way that racing cars or yachts or like anything where the equipment costs, skiing, you know, your equipment costs a lot of money, your stuff, like it's an expensive sport at any level. And then I think, like you say, when you get towards those top levels, I've got friends who are like your competitors and riders and stuff, and it's so hard because you'll see them 1 year winning or doing well, and then you see them sort of drop off the map a bit. And when you speak to them, it's as simple as, oh yeah, that owner gave that horse, you know, someone else has got the ride on that horse and I've not got the horsepower anymore. But I think it's such a difficult conversation, because I know that the sense of the conversation we're having now is sort of negative towards the elitistness. But then at the same time, it's a little bit like hyperinflation has run away with the market when it comes to horses, because there are people who have that amount of money to buy those horses. So if you can sell a horse for $1 million, why wouldn't you sell it for $1 million? So, do you know, like, you see what I'm saying? Like, it then kind of compounds upon itself, because there are people with large amounts of money who have interest in the sport. And in some way they're brilliant, because that means someone who's a rider who has talent but lacks the funding can get a good ride. But at the same time, overall, surely that drives the prices of everything through the roof.
And don't get me wrong, there is riders. I mean, you look at the Whittakers. I mean, John and Michael, they didn't start out with millions of pounds, but look at what they've done, and they've created this dynasty of like Whittakers who now are in the sport. And Scott Brash, and there are lots of riders, and there's lots of eventers as well who've started off without any money. I mean, Mary King's story is just extraordinary.
Yeah, like, I love her story.
Oh, where she came from and how she was.
But she's such a wonderful woman anyway. She's incredible. Yeah.
Do you think back in the past it was easier to come with and build yourself up and get sponsors and get owners and things? Do you think you need more money now to get into the sport, even though they're trying so hard to be more inclusive? And do you think back in the day. I don't know, it's such a hard one, because I know how much the federations are trying to make it so inclusive, and you can go to riding stables, but even just to go for a riding lesson, just to start out, unless you know someone with a pony, it's £50 for half an hour or something.
But again, where does that conversation start, though? So I see a lot of articles posted online, and it will go on about, aren't grooms all paid terribly? Don't grooms work too long or hours and not make enough money? And I agree. But at the same time, they don't put at the end of that article, so you should all double your livery costs. And do you know what I mean? Everybody wants cheaper riding lessons. So people want to pay less for a lesson, but they want the groom that looks after the horses to be paid more. It doesn't work. And I think this is where it gets really weird. Where's that money coming from? Do you know what I mean? It's a difficult...
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because we want to do a sport with a giant bloody animal in it that needs feeding.
Yeah.
But then but you say
but
that.
The, but the expense size of it, it also swings around with... again, I was in London the other day. I'm in London all the time. And I was walking through the Olympic Village, and actually it's similar. I had this kind of conversation with this guy again today as well. The other problem with like equestrian sport, he was saying, oh, you know, it's an integral part of the Olympics. And I was like, yeah, it is. But, there's no, legacy from the equestrian sport from the London Olympics, is there? Whereas there is for virtually all the other sports, because the stadiums are still there and it will still be used. And it's so expensive to run these things as well. Mm. You know, be able to run the competitions and get, you know, where's the money? And we're starting to struggle a little bit with that, I think, aren't we, to be able to, you know, run these events. And the demand is so high, and everyone expects the best ground and the best courses and the best designers and all that kind of stuff, which all cost. And then our entry fees are astronomical. They are astronomical, huge. The entry fees are massive.
I can't afford to do it.
What would an entry fee be for an event these days? Just a general number. Like, I wouldn't have a clue.
It's very dependent on the level that you're at. But, you know, just to do a B100, you're looking at...
85?
Yeah, well, you're definitely looking at a couple of hundred quid to actually do to be able to do the event. So, like, you know, yeah, including the entry, getting there, start fee, all that kind of stuff.
That's a lot of money in real life, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
My rent in my house is like just over 500 a month. So when you're thinking that your entry fee for a competition could be 200, 250 by the time you've done your fuel for a day,
yeah,
you're going to get out twice a month where you could be having a second house.
I don't care who you are. If you've ridden horses, you've had some form of privilege. Whether it be you've created that privilege for yourself because you worked so hard and you can pay for it yourself, but you're still privileged to be able to do it. And I don't know.
I agree.
Just think that people seem to forget that.
Yeah, I mean, but you've got land, you've got a house on land and things like that, don't you?
So we've got 114 acres of grazing. And I've had that since the day I was born. Like we've got all of that. Like, could we have afforded that farm these days? No. My granddad is nearly 100. He bought the farm when he was a young man and has made it and stuff. And a big driver of my career on those days, should I train horses? Oh, but it's cold. Oh, but it's raining. Or I'm hungover. The thing that's driven me in my career is I call it like survivor guilt, because I have the land and the horses. And then add to that, parents ridiculous enough that when I came home from college at Bishop Burton Equine College and said, I'm dropping out and I'm going to do this with my horses. And they said, yeah, okay. For me, not
that
to dedicate.
That's pretty cool. They were so supportive.
Oh, they're just mental. My parents they're brilliant. But it's been more like, from the age of like 12, it was more like living with housemates than parents. But they're... like that big thing for me was I knew so many people who would want to have what I had. Do you know, like to have the horses, to have the freedom. And so I've always, like on those days, if I've been unmotivated, sort of seen that as like kick yourself up the backside, get out there and do it. Someone else would love to be doing this. So go.
Yeah.
Don't. But sort of leading on from what you were saying, Jenny, I think one thing that's quite difficult is, so I do a spring tour at the start of each year where I teach clinics. And I've got 12 in this run. I've done 11. I've got one more to go. And out of the full 12, I think 4 of those will have broken even and not turned a profit. And I charge people £350 to bring their horse on a 2-day clinic with me. And so, like, again, just playing devil's advocate, throwing it in there, for the person coming to book onto that clinic, I fully appreciate that £350 to come and learn with me for 2 days is a lot of money. But then I'm charging people that amount, and then I'm still just breaking even sometimes, not even turning a profit. So it becomes such a difficult game, doesn't it? How do you keep the ship afloat and make it more accessible?
Right. I'm going to turn this around because we've been talking for 20 minutes about finances of sport. So people are probably forwarding past us to it anyway, because they're like, yeah, we know. I'm going to go ask that question, Simon, brief, because this is all about you and we've been talking for 48 minutes. I'm going to do it. You mentioned it earlier. I'm going to throw Ben smiling. He's like, where the fuck is she going with this?
Wait a minute.
So you have been, what's he doing? For anyone who's listening to this on audio and not watching the video, Ben has disappeared from the camera.
I'm ready.
He's opening a beer.
I was getting this fella.
It's a mid-afternoon with me. So you've been doing this sport 20 years now professionally?
Longer, but yes.
I'm going to ask the question. You haven't won a 5-star. I know that for me, just getting to Burley or badminton. I mean, what have you done? Burley 9 times, gone round it clear. Like,
yeah.
Just for me, those statistics are incredible. I know how tough it is to get to these competitions. I know, like, just to even compete at them, you are a hero in my eyes. But the public perception of badminton and Burley, let's face it, those are the ones people watch. Those are the ones that are in the public eye. So anyone who doesn't know about the sport might not understand that there's only 5 of these and only one person can win them, do you know what I mean, a year. What is it that motivates you and keeps you going in this sport when those big wins have eluded you? Like, because for a lot of people, especially if you are a tennis player or something, what motivates them is winning. How is it eventers keep motivated when, if you do win the lower levels, the most you get is a bucket and a rug, if you're lucky.
Yeah.
The real money is in winning the 5-stars and the real glory. Look at Oliver Townend after he won his first badminton. he suddenly became a household name. He had his own brand that he sold stuff. Mark Todd's got his brand. That is where the real proper fame outside of those people who really follow eventing comes. So yeah, sorry, long-winded, but what is it that motivates you to stay in this sport for so long when those big wins have eluded you?
So I did Young Riders when I was 21, and I had a really, really good horse that was doing Young Riders, and she broke down when I was at Chatsworth, it was. And when I'd done Bramham on her, and I thought, now I've done it was 3-star then, but it's 4-star now. I've done a 4-star now, so therefore I'm going to be at this level forever, and it's going to be really easy, and it's fine. And so then that horse broke down. I suddenly realised actually I only had like 2 or 3 other horses that weren't at any level. So I was kind of down and out, and I had to start again from the bottom. And it took me another 10 years before I went and did a 4-star again. And I did. I groomed and for people I. Worked for a lot of different event riders. I worked for Sarah Cohen for a long time, and then I did a lot of freelancing, and it kind of looked like it was never going to happen for me. My dog wanted to come in. And it kind of looked like it was never going to happen for me to do a 5-star. And then it just so happened that when I was freelancing, I rode this really very difficult mare, and I kind of took it, and we did some novices, a couple of intermediates in the end, and I only was thrilled. And that's absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much. And I've actually got another horse which is with somebody else, but I quite like to have it at home now. And would you ride that one as well? And I was like, yeah, sure. And that's the horse that I ended up going 5-star. So it's kind of a little bit by accident that it happened. Sorry, I'm going very long-winded way of answering the question.
If you're boring, I'm still talking.
But because I had that long period of time where it didn't happen to me, and I thought it was going to early on, and then I realized actually this is a lot harder than people realize. To get to that level and to be successful and stay at that level is really difficult. Like, you're very lucky if you manage it. So you need to enjoy the rest of it. And I love bringing on young horses. I love, as long as they're not completely psychotic, I love bringing them on. I love producing them and... Freddie was a bit nuts, but I was so proud of getting him to 5-star level, having dumped his first stitch when he was 3.5, and all that, and I love that's why I love doing it. And of course, yeah, I love going to the events, and that's kind of why I do it, I suppose, to be able to go and compete. This is so bad, and probably I shouldn't be saying it, but it's not about winning them. It's about going in, really hoping that horse that maybe isn't the perfect horse is going to go and make a really good stab at it and be as good as I hope it can be. And, maybe one day I might have a horse that is so good that it actually could go and win because it's done as well as it can do. And that would be great. But, that's fairly unlikely. But you just don't know. And I think that's what I love the most is having producing that horse to be as good as it can be. And also I've tried to, when I had my first job, I went out hacking. The first morning I went out hacking with an owner. It was an event yard, and this owner, she used to come and ride her cob, and she had quite a few horses there. And she said, the main thing that I want is I want to go out. I want to spend time with somebody that I like, who's riding my horses really nicely. And I want my horse to go as well as it possibly can do that day. And that doesn't necessarily mean winning. If it does win, then that's the icing on the cake. And that's perfect. And I've tried to keep that with me all the way through, because I think that's really important. That we do have a really nice time and we do enjoy it, and it's not too stressful. I feel like I'm waffling on, but but I think it's for me. It's never really. I remember talking to Maria, who owned Corner Crew, and her saying to me, I hadn't done a 5-star at that stage. So what's your kind of main aim? And I was like, I'd love to get round Burley. I just like to get around it and have a nice time. And I've done that several times.
A lot of times. Which is great. Yeah. Well, several times.
And that's probably why I am... You're still gone.
I was just going to say, we have one of my favourite little mantras for this is you have already achieved goals that you said you would make you happy. And like you say, looking back on it, if I just get round that, if I get so I'm competing there, then if I can get round clear...
Yeah.
And I think that's what a big thing I would say is that shifting that mindset of would winning be that thing? Like, I know, like, because then it's just, well, now I need to win that one, or I need to win again, or I need, yeah. Like, it has to be, for me, everything with horses has to be about the journey. It's not the destination. Because when you get to the destination, what do?
Yeah.
You pick another one. And so it's learning to fall in love with the process.
It's quite funny. I was at Burnham Market this weekend, and I was in the cross-country warm-up. And I was talking to Gemma Tattersall. She was kind of in there as well. And she's like, oh, just hope the horses that... Yeah, she's brilliant. She's great. She's great crack. And she's like, I'm just feeling stressed. I really want these horses to be okay at the end of today, because, I need them all to be okay to be able to do their 3 days and stuff. And I was like, the thing is, Gemma, it's not about that, is it? It's all about the journey. And she's like, I've been doing this journey for 20 years.
She is like,
it's about time I won.
She is super competitive, though. And she just did the Hickstead Derby. Like, that girl has balls. I'm sorry. But Gemma has, like, honestly, she's just incredible.
She's a star. She's absolutely brilliant. She's great fun, and she deserves all the success she gets.
Yeah, she does. So is there anything... So what question should I have asked you that I haven't asked you if we were to know more about Simon Greaves?
More about Simon Greaves? Oh, my goodness. Not really. I'm fairly transparent.
Which would you rather win? I'll ask this to, I think we should ask this to any eventer that comes on. Which would you rather win, an Olympic gold medal or a five-star?
A five-star.
It's funny, isn't it? No other sport would you say that, really, I don't think.
No, a five-star.
Why?
I would love to win a five-star. It'd be amazing. But like I said, it isn't the be-all and end-all for me. I'd love it if that was that the horse has gone so brilliantly, and I suppose I've been quite lucky in that I've never ridden a horse. It's like, do you know what, this horse could actually win, so like the pressure's on. I've never had that.
Are you shocked by that answer?
For the idiot at the back, why? What's the difference? Explain to me.
It's tougher.
Five star is harder than the Olympics.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Olympics definitely. Is four star, isn't it?
Yes. From a technically speaking, it's easier. And also it's not quite as much as it used to be, but England is weird. Like in the UK, we are absolutely brilliant at this sport, and we have the best place. We're the best place to do it. So all the best people from all around the world come and face themselves here, and they all want to go and win. Well, they all enter up for badminton because they want to be selected for the Olympics, but by doing that, they all come, all the best in the world come together for that one competition. And we do, like in the Olympics, you do get countries that aren't, quite as good. And so therefore the competition isn't as hard. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, that does make sense.
And also, like, just to get around a five-star cross country is a massive, massive achievement. Don't get me wrong, it's a big achievement to get around the Olympics, but it's nothing like the technicality. It's nothing like the difficulty. I
think Ben's properly staring down into space.
I'm astonished.
But it's like, Piggy March, she won badminton and burley on Vanir Kamira. But that mare would never win an Olympic gold because
she wouldn't want to do two show jumping rounds. She'd stick two fingers up at you and go,
no, that's true.
Absolutely not.
But she's wiry. She's tough. She's she's a proper galloper. She can gallop for, because the time is less for at the Olympics than the women for a five star. Five star is seriously hardcore stuff.
It's like the right. I think
you have to be really, really good to win it.
Right, so they'll be doing this podcast for an hour, and we've only got a few minutes left. And before we do that, we need to talk. Suicide awareness is something that's so close to your heart, Simon, and I know you're going to explain why. Why is it that suicide awareness is so dear to your heart, Simon? And tell us a little bit about the adventure you are taking yourself on as well.
I went to go and do a 3-day event at Bicton a couple of years ago, and I didn't have a particularly good weekend, and I came back on the Sunday night, and I got a phone call from a friend. And he said, I've just heard some news that a farrier that's kind of local to you has committed suicide this weekend. And I don't know his name. All I know is it's called Sir. I don't know his second name, but I know your farrier is called Phil. And I was like, well, yeah, but it wouldn't be him because
So it was amazing. Like, he's hilarious. He's the funniest person I know, and he's always on good form, and he's, you know, you never worry about Phil ever.
You posted and, a picture of Phil smiling and shooing Freddie like a week before,
yeah,
hadn't you?
Isn't
he the best farrier? He's always up for a laugh.
And it's like, not all heroes wear capes because he's brilliant. He's brilliant. Anyway, and I was like, it wouldn't be him because he's like, you know, that's just not him. And he's got two daughters and whatever. And anyway, so I materialized that actually it was him. And I found that really hard to deal with. And I'd seen him the week before as well. And to be fair, he hadn't been his usual jovial self. And of course, so like as soon as that happened, I was like, oh, maybe I should have tried harder, or maybe I should have followed it up and rung him that night. But you know, you can't think of it like that. Or I keep on telling myself, but anyway, and I just find it beggars belief for me that somebody who is so happy and so funny and so entertaining and seems so easy and easygoing could do that. And so it's something that is very close to my heart. And I think, I'd like to try and help as many people as I can to not feel like that, because he obviously felt completely, you know, the thing with, I always used to think suicide was a really selfish thing to do. I was like, oh, that's so selfish. But actually, you know, the more I kind of look into it and the more people I speak to about it, the more I think people that do commit suicide feel that they're a burden to everybody else. And so they feel that they're doing everybody a favor by doing it. And I think that's so sad. And
I've lost a few friends to suicide. Someone who taught me, Tom Searle, his name actually came up on my phone the other day. I was scrolling looking for another Tom, and Tom Searle gave me a lesson on Finn jumping on grass to get ready for an event a few years ago now, obviously. And literally a week later, we heard the news, and I was like, he was screaming at me and was like hilarious a couple of weeks ago, and this has happened. And then a couple of other friends, but all male. But you started a campaign, Simon, didn't you, about just asking?
I did. Yeah. So someone's okay. So last year I did. I did the Three Peaks Challenge, which is where you do Snowdon, Scafell Pike, and Ben Nevis in 24 hours, which I have to say was a killer. Snowdon was an absolute bitch. That was the last one we did in the Darkness Idiots. And I was like, oh, wait, I should do it for charity. And then I was like, actually, you know what? No, I'm not going to do it for charity. I'm going to do my own little thing. It didn't gain that much traction, but it did a little bit. It was called Let Them Know. And basically, I said, oh, I don't want any money for this, but what I do ask is that you just go into your phone book and find that person that you haven't spoken to in a little while, or the last time you spoke to, you thought was maybe a little bit down, and send them a message and just tell them how special they are. And because you need to let them know how great they are, because it's important that people do know, because we're really rubbish at doing, especially like us English lot, we are really rubbish at doing that and being open and telling each other how great we are. And I'm going to try and keep, because I'm climbing Mont Blanc in June, and I'm going to do it for charity, I think, but I'm still not 100% sure which charity I'm doing it for. But I'm also going to carry on with that. It's hashtag Let Them Know.
Yeah.
And I think it's really cool, even if no one else does. And to be honest, just one person was to listen to this and go, oh, do you know what? Actually, I really ought to message Sarah or Bob or whoever and tell them how great they are, because I haven't for a while, then that is brilliant. And if it makes somebody feel special about themselves, then good, because we're not very good at feeling special about ourselves.
I think it's so strange, because I didn't even know we were talking about this today, and one of the guys who rides for us, his partner's killed himself. Like, he's announced it on social media today.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So it's really weird. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it is a very real, very, very real, horrible thing, isn't it? And it really is. And
right,
I think that's brilliant. Let them know.
And how did your altitude training go today for your climb?
Not very well. Well, no, it was kind of okay. It wasn't okay. So basically, I don't really understand it exactly how they do it, but there are percentages of like oxygen in the blood and heart rate and all that kind of stuff. And you're supposed to be able to, and they, you put a mask on and it
then that puts you to whatever altitude it is. And we were at 3,000 meters on my second one. And I didn't. And you're supposed to be able to, you're supposed to have the mask off for 5 minutes. But if it goes below 75%, then you have to stop. And in an ideal world, you'd manage to do the whole 5 minutes. And I think I did a minute and 50 seconds before I dropped below 75%. So that's not very good.
How so do you basically, fix that? Give up
so
smoking?
Basically, I need to go onto a machine that, like, so obviously not while we're doing this, but like if I was watching telly or reading a book or doing paperwork or something, put a mask on, have the generator with me, put a mask on, and then so I get used to being at altitude or having less oxygen. It's mad.
And it's mad. Is it safe for you to go at the moment, being that? I was going to say shit at it, but I don't know the best term. Sorry.
So, I mean, I'm doing this all for myself. Like, I'm not doing this because they told me that I must. I'm doing this because, so my biggest concerns about this climb, well, there are three. One of them is that it's really scary. And the Grand Couloir is like the most lethal gorge you can go through ever. Like, I didn't realize quite how dangerous it is to do Mont Blanc. It's really like 100 people a year die climbing it, which is scary. But apart from that side, I'm really scared about the weather stopping us from summiting, because I'll be really cross if I don't get to summit. And oh god,
oh,
my brain's gone now.
And altitude sickness,
that's it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Wow.
Yeah, and altitude sickness, and that making me not be able to summit would really, really annoy me. So, and I was thinking, how can I deal with this? And the best way is to go to see these guys and see how bad I am at it. And I'm not very good at it, so therefore I can do something about it.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you found that out before you went, because I'd be very sad if I was having to get you flown off a mountain, not
breathing.
Would
there be nothing worse, would there, that, oh, I didn't make it to the top, I felt a bit sick. And if I felt sick,
died.
I would be like, I can't do it.
Like, oh, yeah, well, die. Yeah. I didn't realise it was
scary.
Yeah,
no, I don't like that.
Ben's had a lot of moments today where he's just been staring at the screen, aghast.
I'm just enjoying, like, I never know what's going to come out of Simon's mouth. I never know what's going to happen next. Like, we've been on such a journey in the last hour. We've done Simon's childhood, the financial issues of the equine world, confidence building, altitude training, and now possibly... Well, the two things, Jenny being like, you could die on this mountain, and you've been like, I'm going to be so ticked off if I can't summit. And just these two things living in harmony at the same time. I've just, yeah.
Well, I'm very fond of Simi, so I get pretty annoyed if he doesn't come back. Because do you know why I'm fond of Simon, Ben? Do you know one of my favourite things about Simon? Not that he's just like the nicest human in the world and an amazing horse rider. I've got lots of friends, but we all have these ridiculous lives and just everyone has busy lives. But Simon Grieve somehow, just every so often, does drop me a line going, you okay? Everything okay? And he doesn't know how much that means to me. And he's a very special human. And if that stopped, I'm going to cry. I'd be very sad. Because he always knows when to check in on someone, and he's always there. I don't share very much about my life because I don't like dumping on people, but I always know that he doesn't mind if I share a woe with him, or especially since I've moved to Canada, it's been very lonely. And I know Simon has always been there on the end of the phone or on his car drive to work. That's normally the time where he gets time to speak to me. So yes, don't die on a mountain because I'll cry, and I don't like crying.
I'll try not to. I'm sure I won't.
Ben to do the podcast with, and he's hard to get hold of.
Have enough problems on the mountain, though, to make it interesting when you tell us about it. Like,
yes, you know. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Maybe lose a limb or something. Some good podcast fodder.
Again, I'm also just laughing at Jenny being like, yeah, but you want to know the best thing about Simon? After Simon has just given us our talk on, like, hashtag let them know, get in contact with people. Look at, you're like, he's great because you just get in contact with me out of the blue. Like, you'd never guess, would you? It's like, it's just really
right,
made me laugh.
Horrible buggers.
Because he's just gone on about.
Ben, is there a question that I should have asked Simon that you think I haven't asked him before we go, whilst you're glugging on a beer?
No, I don't think so. No.
Well done, Jenny Rudolph. Well
Thank
done.
Thank you very much. I should do this for all the thing. Oh, there's so much more I want to talk about. I've still got, I've been watching. Oh, that's a rant I want to have very quickly, but we're going to save it for another podcast. Horses in the filming industry being tied up outside for hours. But if you want to hear more about that, join us for another podcast, because I even messaged Ben
that's
about
this. That's not me, by the way.
No. Just
FYI, that's not Ben's fault.
The Last of Us is being filmed outside our house, and I saw Pedro Pascal. I didn't know who Pedro Pascal was until someone told me. And they had two horses tied up out all day in the sunshine, and I got very annoyed with it. Might complain to HBO or whoever makes it. Anyway, I digress. It has been wonderful, as always. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please like, share, follow, all of that jazz, and send us who you'd like to hear on the pod and which of the boys you'd like to be chatting to them as well. That could be quite interesting. But yeah, thank you for listening, and yes, all that's left to say is go and shut up and ride.